Hi, I'm Gordon Lanfair, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, a podcast where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers, shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Kent Gordine. Kent is a professor and director of global logistics and transportation at the College of Charleston. On the podcast, we discuss the future of global logistics, trade, and mechanisms for real estate investors and logistics occupiers to take full advantage of the Trump trade disruption. It's well worth a listen.
Kent, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. I'm grateful to be here.
So first, what kind of got you into the world of transportation, ports, logistics? How'd you get your start?
Well, it actually goes back, to my childhood, really. My dad flew for Pan American. So I kind of initially got into that whole thing. And then I got interested in trucking for some reason. I don't know why. But then I was convinced I wanted to be a truck driver. And I think my dad was really afraid I was going to do that. But then Uncle Sam called, and I ended up going into the Air Force, and subsequently being sent back to school to get my degree, which turned out to be in transportation management at the University of Tennessee. And after that, I just I was in it. I had numerous jobs with the Air Force in transportation, and I was telling somebody yesterday that I went in to the Air Force because they were going to draft me. 20 years later, I was standing up at my retirement ceremony wondering how the heck I got there, but then it went into teaching transportation and logistics, and have been into it literally and figuratively ever since.
Look, I've got a couple friends who started in the Air Force and in the U.S. Army in the logistics business, and there's nobody who does it better. I would say one of my favorite logistics stories is always the story of a bunch of Germans during World War II who captured some packages of U.S. soldiers, and they discovered that there was a cake in it that was baked that wasn't already spoiled and had gotten from, someone's mother's, kitchen in Kansas to the front lines. And they said, "This war is over. Like this is not a reality that we're going to be able to compete with." So I'm curious in terms of that to dive into the private sector. Let's talk about ports, planes, and property. So, like, how ultimately are current transportation logistics kind of playing out? We're in this crazy world of tariffs and trade disputes. What are you seeing from a big picture?
It's really early days yet, isn't it? I think there's a lot that we're going to have yet to see about the wider impact of certainly of the tariffs. Transportation is such an integral part of the whole supply chain, and especially the maritime sector, which includes the ports. And yet, I think as a people, we don't really see that very much. It's just kind of outside of our frame of reference. And I think even in a port city like Charleston, it just kind of goes on around us. One of the contributors to that, I think, is that the U.S. has basically got no presence in the blue water, if you will, shipping business. It's all foreign, and so we just don't pay any attention to it. But I will say that once you notice it, for example, in Charleston, when you finally registers, and what's that big ship doing in the harbor? What's in all those boxes? My answer to that is everything. So I think at some point we're going to see a really significant drop in the demand for transportation, because it's just it's not going to be there. And unfortunately, I think that's what happened in the pandemic. It didn't really register on people what the supply chain was or how much we depended on it, until we didn't have it, whatever it is. So I guess that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but I think we haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah, there's a funny little, you know, part of the human condition that nobody really cares about, you know, where their food comes from or if there's enough toilet paper in their cabinet until it's not on the shelves anymore. And so I'm curious to dive into one of the other topics that you already mentioned, and that's the fact that we really don't really have a blue water merchant marine anymore as a large sector of the U.S. economy. And I know I'm probably more knowledgeable about this than our average listener, because I got my degree in maritime law from Tulane, and so I have a lot of friends that work in a variety of parts of the maritime logistics community. I'm curious, when we dive into that, and if you could go into this for our listeners, why that's the case, because many people would sit there and go, the U.S. has a really long naval tradition, as well as a tradition of merchant mariners. And so why is it that the U.S. doesn't really have much of a blue water fleet?
I've thought about that a lot, actually. I think it's not a new problem. I think we dealt with that even before World War II, when we realized after Pearl Harbor we didn't have enough ships to do anything, but we had the shipyards. And so it's kind of not unlike today a little bit, except we had the shipyards then, which we don't now, but that's another story. But we built the capacity, right? We built what came to be called Liberty ships, that were in a way terrible, because we produced them quickly. And so when the Second World War ended, we had a fair number of those around still, which could be used for commercial purposes. But we kind of hamstrung our industry, I think, in that we require that if you're going to be a U.S. registered vessel, you have to have, it has to be built in the United States, it has to be operated by U.S. crews, and it has to be compliant with all the U.S. laws, Coast Guard, OSHA, all of that, which over the years has really made it prohibitive to what we would call flag vessels in the United States. It's too expensive. Over the years, it drove the cost of using them up. And so we ended up in the mid-90s with Sealand, which ironically was the pioneer in containerized shipping. And it was the last one, and it failed. And the remnants were taken over by foreign flag carriers. So,
and why did the U.S. feel the Jones Act, in your opinion, was the right move and not just a free market approach?
Well, I think at the time it probably made sense. You know, that was, I think, passed in 1920 as a part of the National Transportation Act of 1920 or something like that. But it was originally intended to protect coastal shipping from foreign competitors. And for some reason, it's hung on all these years, and has subsequently been applied to the airline industry, to trucking and rail as well. So I think that's, there, the pressure to repeal that has been around almost since it was passed. but it's still in there, and where we see it is with trade into the Caribbean and to Hawaii and the Pacific Island territories and to Alaska. And it really manifests itself in the higher cost of everything that those markets receive because it has to go on a U.S. flag carrier. And I should qualify that. We do have some blue water carriers, Matson, Pasha, Crowley, but they serve these markets that are legally prohibited from foreign competition. And so one of the, you know, the rationales for repealing the Jones Act would be to let foreign competitors come in that could supposedly serve these markets at lower cost. But it's just not gained any headway.
And yeah, when we're talking about the repeal, one of the largest concerns I've heard is that if we were to repeal it, we'd have no blue water fish or no blue water merchant mariners. Do you think that is a risk with the repeal process, or do you think that's kind of overblown by some of the organizations that are protectionist in terms of repealing the Jones Act?
So did you say mariners or?
And I meant by mariners, I meant we would have no blue water shipping capacity whatsoever.
But understand that what we have in those companies that I mentioned is it's pretty small. I mean, their vessels are small. I know that Matson does run a service that includes parts of Asia. But it's basically a loop that they include in a Hawaii service, and I assume Guam and some other place that then just comes back through ports in China and then back to the West Coast. So, but these are not, you know, the 12,000, 18,000 TEU vessels that are being used by the big carriers, and so the economics of running them in more extensive, arguably a more highly demanded service is I think kind of weak.
So one of the things that's highly demanded is time sensitive supply chains, and where we've seen that impact both on the positive and negative. I mean, all of us have probably ordered an Amazon package and had it show up same day or, you know, at least within 24 hours. And we've also all probably had supply chain issues if we've been running businesses where maybe that same day situation has also caused some lack of resiliency within the supply chain. And so I'm curious, what are you seeing from the big picture in terms of how the rise of time-sensitive logistics is playing out, particularly with the trade disputes that we're seeing?
Okay, so I think you're absolutely right. You know, we're, as customers, we just want it.
We do.
And the faster the better. But, you know, that does have its costs. Again, I'm not really too sure that we can say how that's going to pan out. You know, there's a lot of talk now of in this vein of, you know, drones and other types of delivery systems, but they have their own problems. So I think that maybe that's something that we'll have to get used to just being able to get it on Sunday because we can, you know. I mean, do we really need that? But we tend not to be too receptive to answering that question. And it's like, yeah, we need it. We ordered it. We need it now. But it is a problem. And I think it's, one of the ways that you deal with that is that you you know, not to get into to necessarily real estate yet, but, you know, you start storing stuff closer to the markets rather than relying on transportation to do it. And, you know, that's one way you can kind of buffer things, is to, you know, take up some of the uncertainty in transportation with, I hate to say the word, you know, inventory.
So let's dive into real estate, because we've brought it up. So what are you starting to see in terms of how the trade dispute might be playing out in terms of some of the hidden impacts in the real estate world?
Well, you know, and I think the one of the truths about the real estate side of transportation is that it's involves long-term decisions. Right. I mean, yeah. You know, for years in Charleston, we have focused on getting goods into the port and out. Right. It wasn't about keeping them here. And whereas Savannah did the opposite, they early on got into the business of serving the big retailers, you know, setting up distribution centers in Savannah and around to accommodate that. And over time, I think, you know, we but in Charleston, we've kind of embraced that strategy a little bit through the, you know, and we see it with, you know, Volvo locating here, Walmart's got a distribution center here now. And there are others coming. And in addition to the investment in inland ports. But these are, you know, we're still seeing the value of those resources, and of course they all involve real estate. And I think it's you know, in a way, transportation is much more, can be much more short term focused, you know, than with real estate. But they're so closely tied together, I think, that longer term we may see some more implications for that role of inventory in the supply chain that, you know, we were trying to get rid of basically for so long.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, definitively. Typically, when we're working with individuals that are corporations that are supply chain based, or businesses that are looking at supply chain related issues, when they're looking at warehousing, they're looking at an absolute minimum, usually a 5-year decision. So it's very hard for them in this current world to gauge, you know, minute to minute tweet based decisions that might be coming out of the White House, and try to make a 5-year plan based on what could be a 280 character declaration. So I'm curious, beyond just the minute to minute, what have you seen in terms of the evolution that you're seeing take place at locations like Charleston, which I know, you know, affects the general market in the Southeast, as well as just the general market in the US as a whole? And kind of how are you seeing companies look at how they're bringing in inventory and distributing, at least kind of on a bigger picture?
Okay, let's see. You know, this notion of inventory as being bad, I think, was overstated. I think even you know, years ago, it was more about it's not bad. You just don't want very much of it. You want what you really need to attain your overall objectives, which is customer satisfaction, and which is really beyond inventory or warehousing or transportation. And so I think what happened, and especially during the pandemic, which we're now kind of seeing reprised, if you know what I mean, is the reality that, you know, we probably just need to have some more inventory, and not consider it as excess inventory. It's, it's just that it's consistent with the world as it is now. And I think that's kind of where we're at with that. It's you have to have some way of keeping your customers happy, and it's just unfortunate that all of this is happening so quickly that, as you said, it's hard for anybody to know what to do, and maybe maybe that's what we're dealing with.
Do you think that's a general trend towards resiliency over lean supply chains? When you're talking to individuals in the industry, I know pre-2020, everyone was saying lean, lean, lean. It felt like we were on the Atkins diet, know, and now, in this world where we had a number of suppliers who were sitting there, with their thumb up their behind in 2020 saying, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? The port of LA is stuck. I don't have any of my product. And we've gone out in the market with individuals and found multiple additional places for them to store. And they've said, hey, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world if I have an extra 20% or 25% overhead, because I know I can deliver and make that profit, particularly when the market is a little more volatile. But are you seeing that as a trend as well in Charleston, or am I just sitting here in Chicago with our network, and maybe because we're further down the supply chain, people are a little more afraid?
That's interesting, that the way you put that. I think it's both. People are afraid, but it's also this recognition that you have to be looking at the big picture in the sense of your customers, and I think we've already talked about that. This is it's a real big change across the board, and logistics is just a tool, is a part of the equation, and warehousing, transportation, they're a part of logistics, and it's really, I think, about appreciating the balance that has to, the trade-offs that have to be considered in keeping, being able to keep our customers happy and to a certain extent insulated from all of this. I realize that we're trying to do this in the context of, keeping the costs down and by implication prices. But at some point it's part, the customer is a part of this too, I think, Mark. Really, and at some point it goes back a little bit to what we were saying about the lack of appreciation for this whole supply chain thing. And it's like, we can't absorb the whole cost of this as the supply chain. It's a fact, prices are going to go up. And that's a problem for Washington, I think, not really for us, but we have to deal with it, which is the story of logistics, I think, isn't it? And I guess customers to a certain extent as well. So
yeah, I think the story of a business is often tied around a bunch of jackasses in Washington making some dumb moves, regardless of party. One of the things that we've seen is a push out of Washington and out of a number of organizations that are pushing for more electrified vehicles at ports. I know I have a very strong opinions both ways on that. We've talked to a number of individuals that operate out of the Port of LA that have talked about some of the challenges associated with electrification. And I know the Port of LA, being in California, is very different than some of the ports in the Southeast in terms of the surrounding political climate and the push for electrification. But I'm curious what you're seeing in terms of energy, electric vehicles, and electrification at the ports, and how that's playing out.
I have to say, and I guess this is just me talking, but I haven't seen a big push for that yet. It's the front end load on that whole thing is pretty horrendous, isn't it? And especially from the well, I shouldn't say especially, but it's really across the board. It's the trucks. And I think it's perhaps manifest best in LA, where not, you know, the California's got this draconian, you know, rule about that. And you know, you it's pretty conceivable that you'll have the trucks dying in the, you know, in the line because they can't get charged up. So I think that infrastructure issue is what I'm saying is a big problem at anywhere, really. And you know, as far as the cranes and you know, all of the handling equipment at the port, you know, I have seen some of that in other ports, but it tends to be kind of terminal specific, if you know what I mean, because in most places, the ports are strictly landlords. They don't do anything. All of the work is done by terminal operating companies that then, you know, put in whatever kind of handling equipment that they, electric or whatever that they want. Charleston's a little bit different because we are an operating port. And so here we do all the work. I have not heard much about electrification of the port itself here. It's very, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Impactful to observe a port that is totally automated. I have to say, I take my students to Rotterdam every year, and so we get to tour one of the Möller terminals there in Rotterdam, and it's eerie, quite honestly, the extent to which that is being used. But it's not without its implications. It's kind of slow, really, because it is automated, so you can't have automated vehicles kind of whizzing around, you know, kind of unchecked. But I know there are safety steps that are taken, but just as an aside, there's been an automated port in Rotterdam since the Sealand years in the 90s, and that lack of ability to flex the system to take account of different conditions really kind of hampered it a little bit. You know, weather slows it up in places where snow and ice can accrue, and so I think there's kind of a lot of appeal to the, you know, to the internal combustion ports that we have now, barring some advancements in the electrical infrastructure for them. But I guess that was kind of a long-winded answer to your.
So you mentioned some of the challenges with automation. I'm curious if you could dig into that, because I talked to so many individuals further down the line from our ports directly, or our airports, I should say. Like, you know, we deal with a lot of clients in Chicago, Midway, the Milwaukee area. And for those individuals, they see automation very much as the future. Are you seeing that push in the American Southeast eventually? I know there have been all sorts of negotiations going on with the longshoremen, and there's certainly a huge element of U.S. labor relations attached to that. But do you see a more automated future, or are we, you know, for the next decade, are we still going to see very much what we've seen for, you know, 50 years?
Yeah, it's interesting that the labor side of it, because, you know, basically the negotiations that were just concluded were kind of for 6 years, I think, at least here with the ILA. And I think there's a realization that it's somewhat inevitable. And probably the case in point is 50 years ago when we were going through the same thing with containerization. It was the same kind of structural upheaval within the ports, but within the whole maritime industry to deal with the economies that containerization offered. It was the same issue with the jobs and, you know, the tremendous investment in new ships and new ground and sea transportation resources that could move these things, because it was all unique to the maritime industry. And I think electrification or natural gas or whatever the alternative fuel might be in the future, it's going to be the same thing. And so it will be, I think it will come. And it'll probably be forestalled as long as it can be. But I think the longshoremen were kind of smart this time around. It was, not trying to get pushed something that was not going to happen. Any sooner than maybe not even in 6 years, because it is such another huge redefinition of the entire ocean transportation system. And I think it's really the same with trucks. You just can't have long distance trucking that's electric, in my opinion. Unless you do kind of a Pony Express thing, where you have a single load that goes however far to another sort of a depot where it changes out a tractor and a new driver or something and goes on. But you can't have these things charging en route. It just doesn't make economic sense to do it. So I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, with the foreseeable state of batteries, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. It definitely makes a lot more sense at a port where you can have a charging station just a couple feet away versus a long-haul truck. Anybody who's driven across the American West, there's you go sometimes and it's 200 miles to the next gas station. It's very hard to imagine that you'd be able to do that with a truck in any sort of an economically efficient way. True. So one of the other things that we always like to ask our experts on before we get to our final four is what are one of the things or even a couple of the things that maybe our investors or business owners or just anyone from the general public that's listening to gets the most wrong about the transportation industry in general, because I know that there's a lot of misconceptions. What do you think that if there's someone listening that they get the most wrong about the industry?
That's a great question. I think you can kind of see it in popular stereotypes, can't you, of what the perception that, for example, that big trucks are dangerous, and that they cause a lot of accidents, for example, which I think is statistically not true. They may be in accidents, but often those are caused by us. Sorry. I think it's the same with ships that we talked about already, that it's not our problem, really. So I think it's really a lot of different perceptions that are just shaped by the world though as the way it's been. I saw a truck recently on the highway that had on the side of it, this vehicle is basically self-driving. It was on the interstate. Right below it says there is a driver present in this vehicle, but it's being driven autonomously, kind of thing. And my first thought was, that's something we're going to have to get used to, I think, is that um, there's going to be more of that coming. And to get over that or get used to the fact that we can't be, for example, cutting off vehicles or stopping suddenly in front of an 18-wheeler. I mean, who does that? Well, a lot of people do if you watch the internet, you know. And I think it's just a change in how we see things. But I think there is a lot of misunderstanding about transportation and you see it even when we fly, right? As passengers, you know, people get frustrated with TSA, and I'm like, you can check me however many ways you want to. Because I think we're better off for that. And sometimes we're our own worst enemy, I think, but I don't guess you want to get into that.
So I'm not gonna pontificate on the human condition, yeah. But in terms of one condition that we have with this podcast is we have our final four, and we go and every episode we'll ask you four questions. We find them that they're very insightful ways to get to know you a little bit better, get to know a little bit more about your industry, and also to kind of dive into kind of the state of the world in general. So one of the questions that's always my favorite is 10 years out, what do you think will have changed the most about supply chain logistics, trade, and just the transportation industry in general?
It's interesting to ask that question now, isn't it? I think in 10 years, it's going to be a new normal. But I think normal is the operative word there. I think, a lot of this, what we're going through now, is going to be sorted out like it always seems to do. I think global trade will be back to being more where it should be. I'll put it that way. It's just that right now, I mean, in a way, right, looking from here, anything would be better than what it is today. So the reality is that we need global trade. It's really unfortunate to take steps to impede it, especially against countries we think of as our friends. I hope that this will somehow pass and that common sense will prevail.
Yeah, I had a conversation with one of my professors who was a major trade negotiator during the Kennedy administration when I was at Tulane. He was older and had seen trade pass, you know, for the last 70 years of trade, right, over his lifetime. And I thought what was interesting was he said, you know, ultimately global trade will always be there. He's like, the networks will like wax and wane in terms of, maybe it'll be trade with 90 countries versus 120 countries, but there's no way that you can, you know, operate just entirely within your own hemisphere. You need to get coffee from, you know, Africa or Latin America. You need to get, you know, you can only get vanilla or cinnamon from so many places. And so there's always going to be global trade. It might not be every country in the world, but I can't imagine us going to a world where we're only operating on a national mercantile, you know, 16th century level.
True.
So in terms of that, one of the ways that we like to do is also step back in time. We don't need to step back to the, you know, 15th, 16th century, but we can step back maybe to the beginning of your career. And we have a lot of younger listeners, and by younger, I just mean kind of anyone under 30. I'm curious, you give them 1 minute of advice, what would it be?
I would say to find a career that you're passionate about. And it really doesn't matter what it is. I consider myself to be so fortunate to have found that in transportation and logistics, and have been able to take the twists and turns that life kind of presented me that appeared to be roadblocks, maybe, for example, going into the military, retiring from the military, both kind of, what am I going to do now, kind of things. But it was always that love of transportation and logistics that kind of saw me through and have led me to the point that I am now. So I think that, you know, regardless of what it happens to be for any individual, I think that's really the key to success, is to be, find something you love and you know, be flexible about the opportunities that present themselves.
So it's wonderful to be passionate about our careers. And one of the things I'm passionate about, even if I can't pick it up in a physical copy, but I have to listen to it, is books. And I think books are a great way to shape our minds and a great way to get knowledge that we wouldn't ordinarily get. And particularly for our investors and developers, thinking differently about the world is so essential to being successful. So I'd like to ask you quickly if there's a book that we should be picking up.
Okay, wait a second. So I've had my freshmen read a book about transportation, and they love it. Everybody loves it because it's not a textbook, but it's called Door to Door. And right off the top of my head, the author escapes me, but that one is, I think, because it really looks at this issue of transportation, and admittedly it's pre-pandemic, but I think it still resonates. And for somebody that's interested in a quick read, to kind of understand a little bit more about transportation in a macro sense, I think it would be a go-to.
Look, we'll put that below in the comments. There's one thing that I'll make a hard comment on, and we never let anyone get away with not answering this final question of the final four. And it's simply, who's the next person we should bring on? Every individual that we feel that, or we've seen in the past that's in the industry, that's in the arena, tends to have great insight into who are the best people to talk to. And so I'm curious, who should that person be?
Wow. In any field, I guess, huh?
Or it could be any field that you would recommend. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I don't know. She might hate me for this.
That's fine. I started off in brokerage. I don't mind being hated. That's all.
Right. Yeah. Well, I have a student of mine from past years who did my logistics program and went into real estate. And she's done an outstanding job. At one point in there, she made a comment to me about sort of having defected to the dark side kind of thing. But she's in commercial real estate. And I told her, and I said, look, I still claim you as a part of, you know, as a logistics person, because of just what we've spent the past, you know, half hour or whatever talking about. She's got a leg in both fields. So I think she'd be a great one, but you don't have to tell her that I told you so.
All right. Well, we're going to demand that name for you, maybe off camera.
Okay.
But before we finish, we would love to go ahead and, if somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I think now, especially as we're going into summer, the best way is email. And so that's just my last name, Gordine, first initial K, at COFC. For collegeofcharleston.edu.
Thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today, and we'd love to have you on in the future.
Yeah, I'd look forward to it. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again to Kent. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can follow us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.